All right, so we come back this evening to chapter 5 of Genesis as we've been walking through, and we start the next major section. Remember, we have these 10 sections that are delineated by this is the generations of or something to that effect. So you see that as you turn to 5:1, this is the book of the generations of Adam. And so this evening, what we're going to attempt to do is pick up the pace. We're going to cover chapters 5 and 6, and then next week we're going to attempt to cover 7, 8, and 9, and we're going to keep broadening here because we don't want to spend forever, because our goal is to cover the whole Pentateuch, and just, you know, we don't want to be, you know, 100 years old by the time we accomplish that goal. So anyway, we did want to lay a good foundation just in terms of understanding these first few chapters, just which obviously are so foundational to everything, and everything that we see from here is going to be built on what we've learned thus far. And so anyway, anyone want to help me just as we remind ourselves, what is, just in a sentence or two, the flow of thought from chapters 1 to, or I should say really chapters 2 to 11? Chapter 1 obviously is the introduction to the whole book with God's creation, but then as we come to chapters 2 through 11, what are we really seeing in these sections? Anyone? Yeah, chapters 2 through 11. Remember we said
how everything was perfect and then man sinned and then everything turned to
good.
Dust.
I mean, yeah, exactly. I mean, basically you have the contrast with chapter 2 before the fall, and then you have chapter 3, the fall, and everything that just flows out of that. So all the effects of sin on the world. And so that's definitely the section we're in. Last week we saw Cain and Abel, the first murder. We saw Lamech, the first polygamist. And also, you know, just even how he took Cain's murder even a step further, just with, in one sense, what we might even consider to be I don't know what the word we would use there would be, but just, I don't know, even unpremeditated murder where someone just offended him and he just killed him. And so you certainly saw the downfall there, just that sin had an effect just on everyone. And we're going to continue to see just the effects of sin as we walk through this book. Certainly, just keep reminding ourselves as well, the message of this book is a message of hope. Right, just that as we saw all the way back in chapter 3, that yes, God created everything good and sin corrupted it, but that's not the end. There's still hope. God still has a plan for the world, and ultimately, as we'll see, God's plan to bless the world is through the seed of the woman, through Abraham and the Abrahamic covenant. And so we'll be getting to that very shortly as we ramp up to chapter 12. So in essence, we're going downhill to chapter 11. And then in chapter 12, we're going to start going back uphill again and see. But even in the midst of that, you still have, going back to chapter 3, which in one sense is the pivot chapter of the whole book, because, you know, even back in chapter 3, you see that there's going to be this battle between good and evil, right? And you see that battle in the life of Cain and how he succumbed to it, right? We talked about sin crouching like a lion wanting to devour him. And you know, he says, you must master it, but he didn't. And so, but we're going to see this continual battle between sin, between good and evil, between the righteous line and the wicked line. And so we certainly saw the wicked line and just the results of the fall in chapter 4 so clearly. And so that's kind of sets the framework and the groundwork for where we're picking up in chapter 5. But so we still have the flood to come. Obviously, that just emphasizes the sinfulness of man. We have the Tower of Babel, you know, as we're moving towards chapter 11. And so these are things that just continue to show the effects of sin on the world and if you will, establishes the need for hope, establishes the need for salvation. And just within this, we just continue to watch this storyline unfold. Okay, any questions? So as we cover chapters 5 and 6, I should say that really, the section that begins in 5:1 goes through 6:8. And so in one sense, that would be a logical place to stop. But just for sake of wanting to kind of turn up the accelerator on this, we're going to see if we could cover all of chapter 6. And so cover this next section, which is 5:1 through 6:8, but then also use the rest of chapter 6 to introduce us to the flood narrative. And so then when we come back next time, chapters 7 through 9 will have somewhat of a framework established for us to be thinking about the flood. So I'll just encourage you in this week to come, if you have a chance, to read Genesis 7 through 9 and just think about the message of that section as we anticipate coming together. All right, any questions or just other comments to review as we dive into chapter 5? I know it's been a couple weeks.
What should we look for in 7 to 9?
Any of those above mentioned themes? Probably wait until some of those things should be pointed out even as we go through this section. But certainly the battle between good and evil, certainly God's faithfulness, the hope. We'll look through those things. We'll as we introduce it, hopefully we'll see some of those themes develop. Okay. All right, let's dive in. Chapter 5 and verse 1. And you might be tempted to think, here's chapter 5 is pretty much, well, not pretty much, it's a genealogy. And so it'd be easy to read over it quickly and say, okay, this doesn't really have much significance. But there's a message in this genealogy. As with any genealogy, they're in there for a purpose. And so as you read this genealogy, I'll ask you beforehand, before we read it, to be watching out for some things. One, as with most genealogies, they have a pattern. So look at the pattern. Just kind of see the basic pattern that's established in this genealogy. Okay, so that's first of all. Then try to think through with me, what does that pattern emphasize? And why is that pattern given here? And it's interesting as you compare this genealogy with compare genealogies to see that, you know, when you read them quickly, they all seem the same because it's just, you know, father bore a son, but they're distinct. And so anyway, look what's emphasized in this genealogy and see if you can help detect what's being emphasized. Then also, there are three breaking of the pattern. And that this should just be blatantly obvious to anyone that reads this genealogy, that there's a really clear structure and pattern to this genealogy, but three times it's broken. And so find where those three times are as we read this, and ask yourself, why is the pattern broken in those three cases, and what does that emphasize? So as we look through those things, I think you'll see that this genealogy has a very clear purpose. Okay, so let's read it together. Chapter 5 and verse 1. This is the book of the generations of Adam. In the day when God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. He created them male and female. He blessed them and named them man in the day when they were created. When Adam had lived 130 years, he became the father of a son in his own likeness, according to his image, and named him Seth. Then the days of Adam after he became the father of Seth were 800 years, and he had other sons and daughters. So all the days that Adam lived were 930 years, and he died. Seth lived 105 years and became the father of Enosh. Then Seth lived 807 years after he became the father of Enosh, and he had other sons and daughters. So all the days of Seth were 912 years, and he died. Enosh lived 90 years and became the father of Kenan. Then Enosh lived 815 years after he became the father of Kenan, and he had other sons and daughters. So all the days of Enosh were 905 years, and he died. Kenan lived 70 years and became the father of Mahalalel. Then Kenan lived 840 years after he became the father of Mahalalel, and he had other sons and daughters. So all the days of Kenan were 910 years, and he died. Mahalalel lived 65 years and became the father of Jared. Then Mahalalel lived 830 years after he became the father of Jared, and he had other sons and daughters. So all the days of Mahalalel were 895 years, and he died. Jared lived 162 years and became the father of Enoch. Then Jared lived 800 years after he became the father of Enoch, and he had other sons and daughters. So all the days of Jared were 962 years, and he died. Enoch lived 65 years and became the father of Methuselah. Then Enoch walked with God 300 years after he became the father of Methuselah, and he had other sons and daughters. So all the days of Enoch were 365 years. Enoch walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. Methuselah lived 187 years and became the father of Lamech. Then Methuselah lived 782 2 years after he became the father of Lamech, and he had other sons and daughters. So all the days of Methuselah were 969 years, and he died. Lamech lived 182 years and became the father of a son. Now he called his name Noah, saying, "This one will give us rest from our work and from the toil of our hands arising from the ground which Yahweh has cursed." Then Lamech lived 595 years after he became the father of Noah, and he had other sons and daughters. So all the days of Lamech were 777 years, and he died. Noah was 500 years old, and Noah became the father of Shem, Ham, and Japheth. All right, so there's chapter 5 for you. Pretty clear structure, pretty clear pattern, right? What's the pattern?
Well, he says he lived so long and bore a son, and he lived so long afterwards, bearing other sons and daughters, and then he lived so many years and he died.
That's it, right? Pretty clear structure. Just pretend for a second that that's all that this was. That these were all uniform, and you just had a genealogy that started with Adam, ended with Noah. What would be some of the reasons just for a genealogy in general? And even maybe just the structure here. What's being emphasized by this?
They all had a son.
Right. They all had children. Okay? So what would be the purpose of emphasizing that?
Just in the, to carry on the genealogy.
Carry on the line? What did you say?
Yeah. To carry on the line of a particular person. It keeps going down one particular line. They had other sons and daughters. Billy mentioned that son.
Right, so we're following, that's a good point, right? There's lots of other people, but we're following a line, right? It's very linear here. And ultimately, we're tracing our line to Abraham, is who we're going to eventually get at. But it goes back all the way to Genesis, right? The seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent. Right, so you have these genealogies where we're tracing the seed of the woman. Who is going to be the seed of the woman? Who is going to be the one that's descended with it? And we're tracing here the righteous line. The righteous line. So it emphasizes hope, right? That with every new generation, there's the hope that there's going to be this seed of the woman. It emphasizes that new life, just as sons and daughters continue to be born. It's tracing within this narrative, and it's connecting everything back to Adam. And so eventually we're going to get to Abraham, and then Isaac and Jacob, and it all ties back, and it in one sense flows out of this promise that eventually there'll be the seed of the woman. And so, as we said way back in Genesis chapter 3, it didn't answer the question in Genesis chapter 3, who is the seed of the woman? It raises the question, which the rest of the book is going to answer as we continue looking for that seed and watching for him. So that those are good. What else is emphasized in this structure and this repetition here?
Years. Mentions how.
Years, yeah. I don't know what the significance of that would be. I take that back. I read one thing about that. Even that may point to God's blessing. Just even the long lives that they lived. It's interesting because the wicked line doesn't mention the number of years that they live. So I wouldn't push that as a real strong point, but it's possible that's emphasizing God's blessing in the godly line. So good. What else is emphasized?
The line is in verse 1 and 2. It's not just tracing back to Adam, but to God and to their relationship with him as creator.
Good. We'll come back to that. We'll come back to that, but that's clearly emphasized.
Notice that when you read the genealogies that come after the flood, the years are shortened significantly.
Sure.
So that's one that goes with the years, but I also noticed that they all died.
Thank you. They all died.
Andy died.
Some of the other genealogies don't say that. They don't emphasize that. It just says Noah lived, so-and-so lived so many years. So-and-so bore a son, lived this many years. But this one, just the constant refrain is, and he died. Emphasizing the effects of the curse, right? The effects of the curse. God said, you shall surely die. They all died, right? Just the effects of sin on the world. Just constant refrain. And so certainly just death, as Paul would say, death spread to all men. Very, very evident as you come to here. Everyone died. Okay, now. With those things established, the hope that a genealogy shows, just as the seed of the woman is developed, just the constant refrain of death. What jumps out when you have this constant repetition that's just so monotonous in a sense, right? Where it's just like the exact same formula. It's bore other sons and daughters, do this, this, die, do, you know, on and on and on. What jumps out at you? Should be pretty obvious, right?
Enoch didn't die.
Enoch, certainly, first one.
Oh, yeah.
Enoch did not die.
Right.
Just awesome statement here. I mean, it's just so short. Enoch walked with God. I mean, that's this phrase and this whole thing that just jumps off the page. Enoch walked with God. He had a relationship with God. He, you know, these other people lived, but Enoch truly lived, right? He was walking with God. For him, for Enoch, life was not just about the ordinary. For Enoch, it was about relationship with God. And certainly we don't want to, in one sense, make too much out of this, but it just, intentionally, by the author, this just jumps out of the page at us. You cannot miss it.
Is this the first time that Hebrew has used the word walk since the garden?
I don't know about that for a fact. But the way that this is phrased here is, I would say that yes, this is probably the first time. When it talks about God walking in the garden, just the verbal tense here, anyway, it's a hithpael. It emphasizes almost like a reciprocal kind of a walking with God. Anyway, so this very specific usage here, where in the garden God is walking this way, but here Enoch is walking with God. It's emphasizing that it's an ongoing relationship. It's not just, and obviously it's figurative language to walk with God, but it just means that his whole life, and even just think about that for 300 years, right? Where does it say there?
365 years.
Right. You know, he walked with God 300 years after he became the father of Methuselah. His whole life was a life of relationship to God. And so that just jumps out at the page here that, you know, in the constant, if you want to escape the effects of the curse, now none of us can really escape the effects of the curse in one sense, but death, death, death. But the contrast to that is life, right? And Enoch walked with God and escaped the effects of the curse. And so it just is this bright, shining ray of hope that in the midst of the curse, in the midst of the death that's reigning and spreading to all these people, that the person who walks with God can escape death.
It's interesting that there's only one, too.
Yeah.
There's like 10 or 12 people that died. And then there's two. There's Enoch, and then there's Noah. Because it doesn't say, and Noah died. It says that later.
Right.
It says, and then there was Noah. The only two people who didn't die were people who God used as...
They're righteous.
And we'll see... as we're jumping ahead of ourselves a little bit, but Noah also walked with God. Same phrase. And so Enoch escaped death. Noah escaped death as well via the flood. And so these two men, via their relationship with God, there's this statement of hope that we can walk with God and ultimately escape death. And so it's just an awesome reminder to us, just this simple little statement, Enoch walked with God.
I find it interesting that these other guys, even though it doesn't say, shall we say, whether they were righteous or wicked, either way, they're living 800-900 years.
Mm-hmm.
Enoch on earth only had 300 and some total.
Right.
Whereas when it comes to Noah, it doesn't record the birth of his children until he had lived some 300 years. Whereas the other guys were giving birth when they were 80 and 90 years old. You know, Noah was just getting started when he lived 300 years, and Enoch was, shall we say, walking off the face of the earth.
Yeah, just such a short statement, but, and he was not, for God took him. This simple little statement, but it's just in stark contrast to everyone else who died. And so certainly he was somehow translated directly into heaven without dying. Obviously, just from a biblical standpoint, Elijah is the only other one that did not ever die. Awesome statement.
Is that what the phrase, he was not translated as, is the meaning as far as that?
It's just, he was, in other words, he was, I would almost say, it's like, he's just not on earth anymore. He's just gone. It's like you could almost translate that Enoch, you know, and he was gone because God took him.
Well, and it clarifies it in Hebrews 11:5. Enoch was taken up so that he would not see death, and he was not found because God took him up. So it actually means, it's clarified, he didn't die. God just took him from earth to heaven.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the clear... it's clearly taught here as well. But I don't deny that that's further clarified. Absolutely. All right, so just once again, the hope of this whole section, that if one is walking with God, there is hope. All right, what else, what other breaking of the patterns are there?
Noah,
absolutely. So you come to Noah, and this is great here. Lamech, his father, calls his name Noah, saying, "This one will give us rest from our work." Now, Noah and rest they're not the exact same root, but they're related, so it's somewhat of a play on words there, as names often do. And he says, "This one will give us rest from our work and from the toil of our hands arising from the ground which Yahweh has cursed." And so there, in Noah, even just his name, the way this father named him, there's hope of relief from the curse once again. So Enoch escaped from the effects of death, and in Noah was hope that somehow he will give us rest. And it's interesting, you walk through, and this is something to be looking for in the flood narrative, and you might not be able to see this so easily in the English, but there's a few times that it talks about rest, like the ark resting, and various roots based on rest kind of jump into the flood narrative. And so in one sense, Noah is, you know, the connection there between Noah and rest, and just how God used him to obviously spare his people and give them rest, and just some of the implications there. But once again, just hope. Hope from, you know, you read the statement there, the toil of the ground which Yahweh has cursed, and just escaping from that, you know, just the effects of the fall.
This is a different Lamech.
Yes.
Thousands of years from the first Lamech.
Well, actually, probably not that far from the first Lamech, because these two lines are parallel. You with me? We saw Cain's line, and now we're seeing Seth's line. And so actually, Enoch is the seventh in this genealogy. The other Lamech is the seventh in Cain's genealogy. And so there's somewhat of a... typically, or I shouldn't say typically, but often in genealogies, it's the seventh person in the genealogy who's highlighted. And so you could compare and contrast even. The seventh person in Cain's line was this wicked Lamech who was, you know, on and on. We read about him a couple weeks ago. The seventh in Seth's line is this righteous man, Enoch. And so just even to compare and contrast the two lines in that way. Okay, good. So hopefully you see just with these two, just in one sense, short little insertions into this genealogy, how hope is so strongly emphasized. And then where else would we see a break from the typical pattern with the genealogy? It's what Kyle, you wouldn't necessarily think of it, but it's what Kyle was mentioning first off. It's at the beginning of the genealogy. Just as you start off with Adam, it's emphasized, there's some differences there. It starts off with this introduction about how God created man in the likeness of God. He created them male and female. And then, so God created man in his image. And then notice verse 3, when Adam lived 130 years, he became the father of a son in his own likeness, according to his image. Right? And so you see that this image is being passed on. Right? God created man in his image, reminds us all the way back to chapter 1. But now we see Adam's descendants were also in his image. And I think it does remind us of chapters 1 and 2 and God's good purpose for the world. And so we remember that God's purpose was to bless the world. And now we see what? We see man dying just in this genealogy. And so it just kind of reminds us of that original purpose before he goes in. And even right, he says he blessed him. Right? Verse 2. He created them male and female and blessed them and named them man in the day. Just reminds us of some of these key topics from chapter 1 to remind us of God's original purpose, his good design, and then obviously the contrast with just death reigning in each one of these people. But yet in the midst of that death, the hope. The hope that death can be escaped if you walk with God. The hope that there will be rest if you, anyway, if I will, through Noah, and we'll get to him more. Okay? Yeah.
Seems like it also emphasizes the just God's created order. I mean, in the beginning, it's He ordains that each seed will bear its own seed, and
mm-hmm.
so, like you said, with Adam having man in his own likeness, God's order is not—it's not somehow changed in the curse. Man's not going to have an animal. Something silly. It's God's sovereignty and control, even through the curse, is just still very emphatic.
Yeah, good. Okay, so certainly, you know, it's easy to read quickly over genealogy, but hopefully as we come through the genealogies in this book, we'll continue to see what's being emphasized in them. And this one emphasizes the effects of the fall, just in death reigning in people, but yet in the midst of that, hope. And so we'll continue to see that. All right, anything else before we turn to chapter 6? Okay, so as we come to chapter 6 now, we're gonna cover 6, 1 through 8 that finishes off this section. In one sense, it's a shorter section. And once again, just continuing to emphasize the effects of the fall. So, it's chapter 6 and verse 1. Now it came about when men began to multiply on the face of the land, and daughters were born to them, that the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were beautiful, and they took wives for themselves, whomever they chose. Then Yahweh said, My spirit shall not strive with man forever, because he also is flesh. Nevertheless, his days shall be 120 years. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days and also afterward, when the sons of God came in to the daughters of men, and they bore children to them. Those were the mighty men who were of old, men of renown. Then Yahweh saw that the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. Then Yahweh was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. Then Yahweh said, I will blot out man whom I have created from the face of the land, or the face of the earth, from man to animals to creeping things and to birds of the sky, for I am sorry that I have made them. But Noah found grace in the eyes of Yahweh. Awesome little section, right? Certainly, you can't miss just the wickedness in this section, right? It's gotten as bad as it can get. So obviously we need to just walk through this section. So it starts off, came about when men began to multiply. It kind of sets the setting of this little narrative, this little story, that men began to multiply on the face of the land. Daughters were born to them. So certainly just as, you know, we've followed a line, this kind of reminds, you know, as people are living 1,000 years, there's just population explosion. So people are beginning to, you know, multiply just as God commanded them, and the earth is being widely populated, kind of setting the stage for this. And daughters were born to them. And so you read that initial statement, when men began to multiply on the earth, it's pretty general, right? I think it's just setting the stage that just generally mankind was multiplying, was populating the earth. It says daughters were born to them. And so these daughters just seem to be just regular daughters, regular women. The reason I bring that up, because there's no real specification that some of the interpretation of this section will say, well, these daughters were these people, but it doesn't really seem to emphasize. It's just like men began to multiply and the men had daughters. It's like, okay, that's a no-brainer. But he tells us that because it's background for what's going to happen. Okay? That the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were, and this is our key word, good. And here it does mean beautiful, but remember how we saw what? Does this remind us of anything? The tree, right? Eve saw that the fruit of the tree was good. Remember chapter 1, God saw that everything was good, right? And now the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were good. Or it means beautiful, but certainly it's the same word there, and he's playing off that same concept. And we'll see, as you get to verse 5, then Yahweh saw, right? This is what the sons of God saw, but this is what Yahweh saw.
This is the first time since the garden that word's been used, right? Because I don't remember it saying anything else was good till now.
Yeah, I don't. I think so.
So it's probably pretty easy to make that connection.
Right. Yes. Yes. So the question is, okay, what is going on here? Sons of God saw that the daughters of men were beautiful, and they took wives for themselves, whomever they chose. Now, probably most of us are familiar with some of the major views of this, but I would say, based on the usage of this sons of God here, see the contrast? The sons of God, daughters of men. The daughters of men were introduced in verse 1. These were the daughters of men. That just who you'd expect, just the women that were born to those who were populating the earth. And so the sons of God being contrasted to that, this is someone other than, you know, the people that you'd expect. Right? And so there's a number of different views. I'll present the view that I believe is right. And if you have questions, we can. But it seems to be that these are angels. Okay, and the reason is because the Hebrew terminology, sons of God, is one that often refers to angels. And the clearest example of it is in Job. So you could go to Job just briefly. Chapter 1. And this is an almost identical usage. And you could go to verse 6. And don't want to spend too much time, but just to kind of show you this usage here. Now, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before Yahweh, and Satan also came from among them. And so if you read that context, it's in a heavenly context, right? And these sons of God coming to God were angels. And Satan was among these angels coming to God. And so the phrase to us, sons of God, does not connote or does not cause us to think the same thing that it did for the Hebrew mindset. It's this very similar phrases to this are used throughout Psalms of angels. I didn't necessarily write down all those references, but hopefully you could just see the contrast. Like, if they're the daughters of men, if it's going to talk about other men, you would expect the sons of men or some other group of people. When it's contrasting origin here, right? The daughters of men versus the sons of...
Why didn't they just say the daughters?
Right. Obviously. Yeah,
it's the daughters.
Right, exactly. So there's a contrast here between... And so you're some of you may be hearing this and say, that is wacky. Yes, it is. it doesn't really explain this. How can this happen? I mean, we could even... If we wanted to spend a large amount of time with this, we could go to 1 Peter, 2 Peter, and Jude, which talk about this incident and enlighten us more to confirming this interpretation. I think it's clear enough just from the Hebrew in one sense, but when you have three New Testament books which reference the same event and make it clear, like, you know, when you go to 1 Peter, he talks about in the days of Noah, right, that these, you know, something happened with angels, right? It becomes pretty clear that in the days of Noah, that's where we're at here in Genesis, that he's talking about angels here. We don't need to necessarily spend a lot of time in 1 Peter or Jude or some of those things. But anyway, this, and so you ask yourself, okay, what's going on here? Why is this thrown in here? And this is maybe where it gets maybe slightly speculative, but certainly this is the purpose in this section is to show the wickedness. Right, to show the wickedness of mankind. And you're like, well, if it's trying to show the wickedness of mankind, why throw in these demons, these angels trying to come? And what it really is showing here is this cooperation, if you will, between the demonic and mankind. It's showing this link, this cooperation. I would even, you know, once again, maybe slightly speculative, but it almost seems like they're trying to corrupt the human race. I mean, it's just, it's this kind of wickedness that is of such a nature, it's demonic. It's wicked to the highest degree. It's so opposed to God and his plan that God says, I have to wipe out the earth. And so this, you know, we're going to see that there's, the wickedness was not just this, the wickedness was widespread. But this is certainly, in one sense, if you're going to pick an incident or a story that really encapsulates how wicked the earth was and how that... that man was even cooperating with the demonic. Obviously, the line is so important, like the descent from Eve, right? Just think about that for a moment. If this whole genealogy, this line is corrupted, right? Well, it could thwart God's plan in a sense, right? And so they're coming in trying to mess up God's plan. That's kind of how I would see this here.
Well, we're right down to one righteous man and his family.
Right, absolutely.
I mean, so, shall we say we're down to a pinpoint of righteousness within mankind, and it's the seed of the woman that's going to crush the head of the Satan, right?
Absolutely, so, absolutely. So I mean, you're absolutely right.
In one way, he's rescuing the seed before it's totally corrupted.
That's a great way to put it. Yeah, Kyle.
Clearly in verse 3, Yahweh is disappointed with man, and in verse 5 also.
Yes.
Are you then saying that that's mankind and not... Are you saying that's mankind? Because it's... If the sons of God are angels, then it's not men. It's not males.
Right, mankind. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely, mankind. Yeah, and that's very typical for us.
We're the only ones that are engaging that's such that God is displeased enough that he's making these pronouncements. And
right, yeah, it's mankind. And I mean, I don't want to get too speculative here. Obviously, you could let speculation run wild in this passage. But it's possible that even the way that this worked out was through... I mean, one of the views is that angels possessed humans and did this. I mean, I don't want to get it's the details of how this happened, how these angels did this. It doesn't say, but there's definitely some sort of human cooperation, whether it be on the support of the women, if there's men involved. We don't necessarily know all the details of how it's worked out. It's not trying to explain that to us. It's just trying to show the height of the wickedness. And certainly, as you say, it's mankind that's judged for this, for their cooperation, if you will, in this satanic scheme. And that's definitely the emphasis, is mankind's wickedness in this.
And is that clear in the Hebrew? Because I would read that and say that might be one of the views for proving that sons of men are men, or sons of God is a term for human men, because God is... I don't know, I haven't read all the views, but it seems like those verses would support the other... Unless it's very clear that man means mankind.
Yeah, I would say that man, meaning mankind, is very, very... even just the fact that when God says, I'm going to wipe out mankind, he doesn't mean just the males, right? It's the flood. It's universal destruction. So it's very clear that when he's talking about, I'm going to wipe out man from the face of the earth, then he means mankind. He doesn't mean just men. And certainly there are other words... For instance, run back in your mind to Genesis chapter 1. God created man, you know, in the image of God he created him. Male and female, he created them. There's a different word for male. This word is the generic word for man that means mankind. Now, it can mean men, but it more means mankind than just a man, necessarily. So I think in this context of just the Hebrew usage, it's clear it doesn't mean males.
It also seems unusual that, like, it doesn't mention God's... Like, the angels were judged, too, you know, that from the New Testament, right?
Right.
But it doesn't mention that here.
Right.
But thank God.
But they're already condemned, the fallen angels.
Right.
Their fate's already sealed.
Right, but I think that that's what gets into the purpose and the flow of this, is showing the effects of the fall, and it's all centers around humanity, right? And just... God's purpose for humanity is to crush the head of the serpent and just the effects of the fall on mankind. And so, yes, angels were involved, but it's not really... Angels aren't at the center of God's plan. Mankind is. God's plan is to redeem the world. It's to save humanity, to bless humanity through the seed of the woman and through the Abrahamic covenant. And so... that's why this passage doesn't deal with the details. It just shows the wickedness of man in participating with demons. So I think it has a lot to do with just the flow of thought of where he's going. I mean, it's not an easy passage. I think it becomes very clear when you study the New Testament passages. If you just had the Hebrew and none of the New Testament, then I could see more debate. But as I would study 1 Peter, 2 Peter, and Jude, it kind of nails the nail in the coffin for me with this view that it just seems very, very clear that it's angels. And even just this phrase, sons of God, it just how it's used in Job to refer to angels, I think that's what trips us up, is we hear sons of God, we think men. They heard sons of God, they thought angels. And that's evidenced by their usage in Psalms and elsewhere. It's not, the word sons of God isn't really used of men. But it's really kind of a phrase that seems to be reserved more for this angelic idea. Because just like, anyway, I don't want to get into that too much. All right, and so, go ahead.
A question popped in my head. Okay, we have these two parallel lines,
mm-hmm.
right? Cain and Seth. And there was Enoch. And put it crudely, he was Mr. Goody Two Shoes, right? And now he's gone. Right after he died, and there's some more. And now we have Noah. So both lines are thoroughly corrupted.
Although the corruption of Seth's line isn't necessarily emphasized, but almost by silence and omission. Like you said, I mean, there's no one else on the boat except for Noah and his family.
Right. Well, Seth.
Yeah.
And I'm just thinking that these people in the genealogy, now it's not an important thing, but it's just my curiosity of knowing if some of those people in the genealogy, shall we say the aunt, the great uncles and stuff of Noah, they're seeing this young boy grow up, right? Establish his family. They're going to die in this flood.
Well, that's a good point. Let me bring something else.
When you think about it.
What's interesting, though, if you add up the chronology here, it appears that Methuselah died 1 year before the flood. So, you don't necessarily say that some of these people died before the flood, and so they weren't judged by the flood.
Oh, no, but I'm saying there are a lot of people, because it's just, you have the other sons and daughters, right? We only have this point-to-point enumeration, but you have all these other people.
Oh, yeah, certainly.
And they're...
Sure, absolutely.
They're reproducing,
You have a lot of other family members that are going to die in the flood.
Right, and it's just, when you think about it, outside of Noah, whether his mother and fathers or siblings or anything, they all die.
Yeah, it's, as you said, it's an awe-striking thought that Noah and his family were the only ones that survived the flood. 8 people. The whole earth. And the earth was hugely populated. I mean, we don't know what the population was, but if people were living 1,000 years and having tons of kids, this could have been a vast, vast number of people. All right, so as we continue on, notice what it says. Then Yahweh said, "My spirit will not strive with man forever, because he is also flesh. Nevertheless, his days will be 120 years." So it seems there's two different views onto what that 120 years is, but it seems most likely that that's how long until the flood. Some people think that that means that God limited their lifespan to 120 years, and that's a legitimate view. And it's hard to answer that, except for some people lived over 120 after this. So it seems like God's saying 120 years and the flood's coming. God put it's like Jonah, right? 40 days and Nineveh will be overthrown. He gave him a timeline. And certainly it probably would have taken Noah 120 years to build the boat, given the size of that thing. So anyway, it's a good thing that God didn't send the flood immediately, or else he wouldn't have had much more than a raft.
I was kind of wondering, probably everyone's on the same page, but when you're talking about the angels and stuff like that, were you kind of saying like that the angels wanted to like stop God's plan? It's kind of like, I wasn't really sure. So they kind of like, in a way, corrupted man, like worked with man and everything to ruin God's plan?
Right. Because when it talks about here, well, it says, you know, the angels took wives for themselves, right? And so then if you look back here to verse 4, the Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and afterward when the sons of God came to the daughters of men, and they bore children to them, those were the mighty men of old, men of renown. And so somehow seems to be, once again, I don't want to get too speculative, but it seems to be that what the text is saying here is that through this unholy union, if you will, that children were born that were these Nephilim. And these Nephilim were the men of renown. They were the tough guys, if you will. They were the, what else does it say about them? Mighty men, right? Just the warriors would probably be a better translation even. That they were the warriors. And that's the same word like when the Israelites go in to the promised land. It's like, these guys are giants. It's like the Nephilim. You know, it's like they had heard this story from Genesis, and they knew that before the flood there was these giants, and so they see the people in the Canaanite cities, like, these guys are like the giants that we heard about in Genesis. You know, and so these guys were men of renown, they were notorious, they were famous, they were kind of like these warrior type people. Once again, God says, my spirit is not going to strive with man forever. This has got to stop just because of the wickedness. And so verse 5 continues on with that theme. Yahweh saw the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and that every intent of the thought of his heart was only evil continually. Right? Just the complete and total wickedness of mankind. Every intention, every plan, every thought, every desire was only wicked continually. And so that's the reason for the flood. God is going to judge sin. But in the midst of it, right? No, oh man, even just this, you read verses 6 and 7. This is tough. Then Yahweh was sorry that he had made man on earth, and he was grieved in his heart. Even that word there for grieved in his heart, it's interesting because that's the word there. It's, you know how we talked about how in the curse, remember that there was pain? There was pain in the woman in childbearing. There was pain in the man in his work. And so sin caused pain for mankind. But here we see why sin causes pain for mankind. Because sin causes pain for God. And obviously I would say that these are, I would call these anthropomorphical, you know, that. When it says God was sorry that he had made man, obviously we see so much in the course of this book that this is all part of God's plan, that God has a plan to restore blessing, that this is all, I mean, the sovereignty of God is so strongly emphasized that I have a plan about how to bless the world. It's through the nation of Israel. I don't think that God, you know, changed his mind and said, oops, I made a mistake. But it's so strongly trying to emphasize in a way that we cannot understand. We cannot understand God, but it's seeking to communicate to us how grievous this is to God. How grievous this is to God. And just, you know, sin pains God is really literally what he says. Sin causes us pain, but sin causes God pain. To the point where he, in one sense, regrets that he had made man on the earth. And certainly we could get into a huge theological discussion, you know, is God, you know, did God like change his mind? Did God's plan? And I don't think that this is implying this. I don't necessarily want to get too much into that. But certainly you don't want to downplay it either and say that, and downplay sin, right? This shows how grievous sin is, to the point that God says in verse 7, I will blot out man whom I have created from the face of the earth. From man to animals to creeping things to birds of the sky, for I am sorry that I have made them. But the sweet thing is how this section ends. But Noah found grace in the eyes of Yahweh. I wouldn't translate that favor. It's the word for grace. Certainly favor is an appropriate translation, but I don't know if it really brings out the full significance of this. In the midst of all this wickedness, in the midst of everything, Noah found grace. And we'll see that Noah was a righteous man who walked with God, but it's interesting that grace comes first in the narrative. It's not that he found grace because he was righteous. It just starts off by saying he found grace. And later we will find out that he's righteous. But ultimately, it's God's grace. It's God's freely given grace that Noah, in the midst of all this wickedness, walked with God. And he trusted in God and he was righteous. And so, once again, just hope in the midst of all of this. Right? That God is a gracious God. That God would give grace to one man to preserve the plan, to send his peace upon the world and his plan for the world. In the midst of all this wickedness, as you said, you know, you're just emphasizing it, but when you see it got to the last thread, you know, the world was hanging by a thread, as it were, just ready to, you know, God, but God had a plan. God's plan would not fail. God's grace was evident in the midst of all of this. And so it just, it should just cause us to just marvel in God's plan. That, and at the same time, just cause us to see the sinfulness of sin. It's a great, great lesson for us. All right, anything about this section here in 5:1 to 6:8 before we kind of dive in? Yeah.
I just can't get away from that Piper sermon or series on Romans 8, and I hadn't noticed this before, but in verse 7, just the effect of sin, God's curse on creation. I mean, animals and creeping things and birds of heaven had nothing to do with man's disobedience, and yet just the link or the connection between God punishing mankind and subjecting all creation to futility, and then the reversal of that, you know, that we have to be redeemed before creation can. I mean, it's just so huge. It just affects so many things. How we think and act and steward and relate to, and it's just massive.
I think even just within that, you see, and maybe I'm just saying what you're saying from a different angle, but you see God's plan for the universe and for the earth centers around mankind.
Yeah.
It's all about God redeeming mankind. That really is what you're saying. And so it just gives us an awesome sense of what God is doing in the world.
But also just a reminder, I think that's one of the things that Piper mentioned, just that when I see creation, you know, the suffering of not just humans, but especially humans, and I see the suffering of creation, it should be a reminder of the cross. And I mean, everything should, but just to not forget that aspect of the futility of creation, and almost like that is the purpose of it, to remind us of. So if we just look at suffering and the futility of creation and don't think about the purpose of that suffering in creation is for us to be reminded of sin, then like we're wasting and not being reminded of God's purpose through that.
Yeah, sin, that's great. Just sin's effect on all of the universe, and when we see that effect, we're reminded of sin and the need for hope, which is the message of this book.
It's good.
I think it's interesting to know verses 6, because Moses was saying, Moses wrote the letter.
Yes.
But the Lord was sorry that he made man on earth, and then in verses 7, God said, I am sorry. Just the emphasis there starts with they're sorry, then including with God saying, very sorry they made creation.
Yeah. He was grieved, he regretted. Yeah.
It's very dramatic. It's almost like, I don't want to reduce it down, but watching a sitcom or something, you can hear the narrator say, the Lord was sorry, and you can sort of see the Lord and his feeling. And then you hear him say, oh, I am sorry that I have made him. It's like doubly grave and remorseful. And
yeah, absolutely.
You know, I kind of think of, I mean, and this is on a human plane, of course, but like when we hear stories about, you know, some kid or young man, you know, takes a gun and kills multiple people, you think about what the parent of that person, if they have any semblance of healthy attitude, you know, towards life. What kind of sorrow and grief they must experience. You know.
That's a good analogy. That's a great analogy.
You know, it's an incomplete, though.
Right.
But.
No, yeah, that's, I mean, and in one sense, any description of God it needs, by necessity, is incomplete because he is infinite and we are finite.
Right.
So that's why, you know, you use human language to describe God, but, you know, it's a picture, it's an analogy to help us to understand it's the grievousness of sin. That's what he's trying to communicate to us. And we treat sin lightly. We treat it lightly. And this passage is intended to show us how just grievous it is to God and just the effects of sin on the world.
That's good.
But don't you think because there's so much of it that we kind of become callous?
Yeah, absolutely. And certainly in that day, right? Where it's pervasive. That's every intention of their heart was only wicked all the time.
Right.
Just to where that was everything. Absolutely.
Yeah, that'd be horrific.
I think we've got to remember, too, that it's not, it wasn't all, you might say, perverseness. Because what it was saying was nobody was seeking after God.
Right.
I mean, they could have been, shall we say, by most respectable people in some ways, but they were not seeking after God.
Well, they may have looked respectable, but surely in their hearts, the thoughts of their heart was only evil continually.
Right. And that's I think, what she's emphasizing. Yeah, absolutely. That's good.
I think it's interesting, I'm talking to this Jewish guy at work, too. I talked to him about, hey, will you read Hebrews? Can we talk about it? And I'll let you read it in modern Hebrew. You know, I have a copy of it. And he said, I don't want to read it. I'm not interested. I'm like, all right, well, I'll give you a copy, and then will you read it? And he said, well, are you going to give me a Bible? I don't want a Bible. And I'm like, no, I'll print it out and give it to you. And we started talking about it. I said, well, what if I read the Torah? I would read the Torah again. We talk about it. And he says, well, there's all these interpretations of it. I think it's an obvious and simple point, but it's one that's worth fighting for these days. And it's really a literal story. Like, this is actually what happened. This is not, it is a metaphor, but it is a metaphor when interpreted metaphorically, looking back at a literal event. Like, the New Testament defines these things as literal, but then takes them as metaphors. They actually happened, and you can look at them as metaphorical things, but they're not metaphors. They actually happened. It was real. It really occurred. It's not spiritualized here. You know, this is real.
Yeah.
And it's not debatable.
It's real history, absolutely.
It's not questionable, you know. I think it's worth mentioning, because not many people believe that. You can say, well, the Bible says this literally, and they go, you're crazy. Everyone on the earth died. Yeah, everyone on the earth died. Except for like 8 people. Everybody. Yeah.
Alright, so that concludes this section. We move on to the next one. This next section, as we said, starts here in 6:9, is going to go through chapter 9, but we're just going to introduce it to kind of get our minds rolling for next week when we cover that whole section. So just quickly, let's go through this section. And even just remember, when we say we start in verse 9, these are the records of the generations of Noah, just like we did, this is the book of the generations of Adam in 5:1. It's like, this is what happened to Adam. This is what happened to Adam. Now verse 9, this is what happened to Noah. This is what became of Noah. Let's trace out what happened. What are the results, right? God made the heavens and the earth. What happened to him? What's the results? And now we're going to see what happened to Noah. Noah was a righteous man. Blameless in his generation, or blameless in his time, Noah walked with God. What an awesome introduction, right, to Noah. Righteous man, blameless in his generation, he walked with God. Noah became the father of 3 sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Now the earth was corrupt in the sight of God, and the earth was filled with violence. God looked on the earth, and behold, it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way upon the earth. Then God said to Noah, the end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence because of them, and behold, I am about to destroy them with the earth. Make for yourself an ark of gopher wood. And you shall make the ark with rooms and shall cover it inside and out with pitch. This is how you shall make it. The length of the ark 300 cubits, its breadth 50 cubits, and its height 30 cubits. You shall make a window for the ark and finish it to a cubit from the top and set a door of the ark in the side of it. And you shall make it with lower, second, and third decks. Behold, I am bringing the flood of water upon the deluge of water upon the earth to destroy all flesh, in which is the breath of life, from under heaven. Everything that is on the earth shall perish. But I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall enter the ark, you and your sons and your wife and your sons' wives with you. And of every living thing of all flesh, you shall bring two of every kind into the ark, and to keep them alive with you, they shall be male and female. Of the birds after their kind, and of the animals after their kind, of every creeping thing of the ground after its kind, two of every kind will come to you to keep them alive. As for you, take for yourself some of all food which is edible, and gather it to yourself, and it shall be for food for you and for them. Thus Noah did, according to all that God commanded him, so he did. Great section. All right, so we're starting the flood narrative. Now, any words that you see repeated throughout this section? So we read it?
Make.
What's that?
Make.
Make? Yes, good. Make. God gives them very precise commands about how to make this ark. Just the obedience. And that's going to, as you walk through this section, as you get to the end of it, that's when it says, thus Noah did. It's the same word as make. Just like in Greek, the word for to do and make is the same. In Hebrew, the word for do and make is the same. And so Noah did, Noah made, just according to everything that God commanded him. And God commanded him very precisely how to make this ark. Right? How many cubits, how many this, how many that, put the door here, put the window here, do this. And Noah followed it completely. And that's a huge emphasis in this section. And just that key word, remember, all the way back to the garden, God commanded Adam regarding the tree, right? There's this command. It's this key word that comes up in Deuteronomy, my commandments, right? God says, you got to keep my commandments. And here, you know, there was a commandment to Eve and there's a commandment to Noah. Noah did everything that God commanded him. So complete obedience. And that's what that word made is really emphasizing. Make this, do this, do this. Noah did everything just as God commanded him. He completely made it just like God said. So complete obedience is emphasized here. Now obviously, the application for the Israelites is what? Right? Obey God. Blessings for obedience. You want to be saved, right, from God's wrath? And I'm drawing the application out at this point. But you want to be saved from God's wrath? Obey. Trust and obey. So great, that's obviously major emphasis in this section. Good. What else is repeated?
That's the first time it's said commanded, hasn't it?
What's that?
It seems like, again, the first time that it's mentioned that word, again.
Since the garden, you mean?
Yeah, because I noticed it says, just like you said, he commanded Adam not to eat, and now God, Noah did everything he commanded him.
Yeah, I think that is the first time since the garden.
Interesting. He's doing all these things again. I think flesh is mentioned over and over.
Yeah, certainly the totality of God's destruction, all the earth, everything under heaven, like we said, birds. And I mean, this is, I don't think you could read this and think it's a local flood. I mean, everything under the heavens, right? All flesh. It's just so emphatic. This is complete destruction because of God's justice, God's wrath against sin. And so that is emphasized.
It's
I heard it. Sorry.
You shall.
Yeah, that ties in.
You know, he doesn't say pick for yourself your favorite kind of wood, you know, and make it as large as you want. He just says you shall, you shall, you shall, and there's no options.
Good. Absolutely. And just once again, that ties in with Noah's complete obedience.
Yeah.
I think I heard it. Did someone say?
Corrupt.
Absolutely. That's a major emphasis in this. God looked on the earth and behold, it was corrupt. For all the flesh had corrupted their way. Then God said to Noah, the end of all flesh, where does it say? Oh, sorry, I missed it. The first one was, now the earth was corrupt. Three times. Now, That's not all the times. Because, as is typical, you can't really bring out the nuance here, but in Hebrew, the word for corrupt in one verb tense, in another verb tense, means destroy. And so when it says God destroyed, and I can't really, without doing the Hebrew for you, I can't really show you the connection there, but the earth was corrupt, there's a direct connection, so God destroyed it. And so the author is purposefully showing this connection that God's destruction of the earth was just. That's the emphasis by using the same word there. That the destruction came because of the corruption. And there's a direct connection there. And so it's emphasizing God's justice in bringing this destruction on the earth. Right? When it uses the same word, it's like, well, if this is the case, then this is the appropriate response to that corruption. So corruption, destruction, same word. And so in a sense, as we walk through this flood narrative, you're going to see somewhat of a recreation. God's starting over. He wiped them off. It's like wipe the slate clean. That's the word that's used here. Where is that word? It's on here somewhere. It talks about, maybe it's in the last section. Oh, verse 7. I will blot out man whom I have created from the face. Just wipe the slate clean. Just, all right, let's start over. And that's the picture there. Take a chalkboard and get the eraser out, and let's start over with Noah. And so, even just interesting with that, go, when you read through the flood narrative, look for parallels between Noah and Adam. I think you'll at least see one. But there's somewhat of a starting over with Noah. And so we'll see some of that parallel with Adam. But yet at the same time, we'll see sin is still in this new world. But you still have the hope. It's still God's grace. What's that?
It doesn't take very long.
Yeah, absolutely. So those are, I think, what are the major emphases in here. Just think, three times we see corrupt, but then twice we have destroy. So five times in this short little section, you have the same word that's being used here. So extreme corruption, which is going to result in destruction. And so God's justice is emphasized, his righteous wrath against sin. And just obviously, as we started off, Noah walked with God. Right? Noah walked with God. You want to escape death, Enoch, you walk with God. You want to escape the flood and complete destruction, you walk with God. The application is obvious. We need to walk with God. Right? We need to be in relationship with him, an ongoing day-to-day relationship, not just, whatever else. There's hope for those that walk with God. And yet God's still going to accomplish his plan. He's working out his plan. We're going to continue to see this unfold as the book goes through.
It's interesting how corrupt things were, like how bad it was. And like you said, how there's hope for those who walk with God. No one could ever argue that it is so bad now that they can't walk with God. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, it's so hard to walk with God. Well, how do you think Noah had it? there's no excuse in terms of, like, the application.
Yeah.
It's always you walk with God and you're fine. Everyone is dying in the genealogy, and then Enoch walks with God, and he doesn't suffer the same consequences. He doesn't suffer what they all suffered. Noah is the same way. Even in the worst circumstances, they're all dying. Or like they all are about to die.
Good. And then let's close with this. Verse 18, but I will establish my covenant with you. This is key word. First time it occurs in Scripture, the word covenant. And obviously such a significant concept for the Pentateuch. Just the covenant is God's relationship with Israel. And here there's this the maker obliges himself to keep commitments that he's made to Noah. And once again, in a covenant, there's two sides of a covenant. And so on the one side of it is God's faithfulness. On the other side of it is Noah's faithfulness. And that's what's emphasized in this section. Noah's faithfulness. He obeyed God. He walked, if you will, in the covenant. He did what God commanded him to do. And God was faithful to him. And we'll see God's faithfulness, right, as the ark saves him. right? God kept his side of the promise. God is faithful. And so obviously to the Israelites, that is such a directly applicable theme to them, right? God will keep his promises. He will, no matter how outrageous it is, like, make, you know, saving you in the midst of a worldwide flood through this ark, doesn't matter how crazy it is, God will be faithful to his covenant if you are faithful to him. And so obviously that, you know, as the Israelites are going into the promised land in the covenant, right? The whole Old Testament is about covenant faithfulness. Are you going to obey God? Are you going to keep that covenant relationship, that the relationship that's like a marriage? Are you going to be faithful to it or not? And so Noah was faithful, and so Noah experienced God's grace, and Noah experienced God's salvation. And so obviously it's because of that righteousness, that faithfulness, that walking with God, that, that ongoing covenant relationship. And so that is so central to the heart of this. And as we walk through the flood narrative, that's one of the things you're going to see, God's faithfulness to Noah, right? God's saving of Noah. And yet at the same time, God's outpouring of wrath on sin and just the wickedness of sin. And so I think that's a fitting place to end as we conclude this section. Once again, we continue to see God's plan unfold in such an amazing way. And in amidst just the total and complete corruption and wickedness of the earth, God's plan is not going to fail. And God is still preserving the line. He still is going to keep that promise, right, to crush the head of the serpent. And so it doesn't matter how bad the circumstances look. It doesn't matter how hopeless it looks. God is still going to keep his promise, right? You could trust in God's promise. The what we're called to do is walk with him in the midst of it, depending on his faithfulness. And so God will accomplish his plan and his purpose for us. And we've talked about that, just God's desire to bless the world and all that. But this is the application for us, right? We could trust in God. He will be faithful to us. He will do what he has promised. We just need to be faithful to him and to walk with him and to hope in him. And so it's a great lesson as we continue to walk through this book. All right, any concluding comments or thoughts? We just continue to walk through this book.
We're listening to 2 Peter all week, and he mentions Noah. If God did not spare angels when they sinned, but cast them into hell and committed the pits of darkness reserved for judgment, did not spare the ancient world, but preserved Noah, creature of righteousness, with seven others, and brought a flood upon the world of the ungodly. He talks about all these other people, if God could spare these people. Verse 9, then the Lord knows how to rescue the godly from temptation and to keep the unrighteous under punishment. It's interesting that, like you said, you know, if we walk with God, there is hope for us. You know, if God can do that in the midst of those things. He mentions Noah and Lot and how he can rescue them. He can rescue you, you know, if you trust in him.
No, that's a great application as you read through this. God knows how to make a distinction. I mean, going through the minor prophets, that's one of the things in Malachi. They're like, hey, how come God doesn't do anything? How come he's not acting? How come he's not judging the wicked and blessing the righteous? I don't see God working. And just a reminder, like you said, from 2 Peter, God knows how to do it. God knows how to judge the whole world and save 8 people in the midst of doing that.
Yeah.
Right? God knows how to like wipe out Sodom and Gomorrah and save Lot in the midst of it. And so the same is true of you, right? God knows how to make a distinction between the righteous and the wicked. He knows how to do it. And so trust in him because he will save.
He says, like even what if you're the righteous one in the midst of all this wickedness? Well, that's Noah, and apparently that was Lot. Like, sometimes he gets a bad rap. You know, oh, he's sitting in the gates of Sodom. He must be a wicked man too. But it says in here, if God rescued righteous Lot, oppressed by the sensual conduct of the unprincipled men, for by what he saw and heard, that righteous man, Lot, while living among them, felt his righteous soul tormented day after day by their lawless deeds. It's like, Lot was this righteous guy. Like, if you're a righteous person, even though you're surrounded by all this wickedness, there's still hope that God can make a distinction. Like, even if you're the only one at work, even if you're the only one in your family, even if you're the only one in your church or wherever, that's trying to do the right thing, it's irrelevant. You know, like, it doesn't Like those things, it's okay. You know, God can make a distinction. He will. He understands how to rescue you, how to point out his plan.
I think, too, in terms of man, the word righteous does not necessarily imply perfection. It doesn't mean that everything they did was right, because we know King David was a man after God's own heart.
Yeah, and certainly even Noah here, he was a righteous man, but well, I don't want to give away, but he sinned.
Yeah,
he has some problems. Don't read it. I want you to come back next week.
Right? Stay tuned.
Don't read ahead.
No, do read ahead.
No, but I mean, I think sometimes we use that word and say, well, I can never be like that, you know. I've already made big mistakes, but that's not...
Yeah, that's good. That's good. It's good reminder.
Both Lot and Noah, though, are a great example of what she's saying, you know. Both of them, almost immediately, same thing. You know, righteous, but still failing.
Just thinking about that, walking with God and just tracing that way through Scripture and walking in a manner worthy... which you've been called. And, I mean, for us, we don't even just to think about that word, like, we don't walk anywhere, you know. I mean, in Africa, women and children walk 4 hours a day to get water that, you know, kills them and gives them diarrhea. I mean, I don't want to import a modern day word, but they're closer to the reality of understanding what it is. When you think of these men, Abraham, and people who obeyed God, and there's a physical requirement or behavior or consequence to their fleshing out their faith. And so just that word walking with God, what all that entails is hard for us to think about because we don't walk anywhere.
Yeah, it's an ongoing daily relationship.
Interesting. Then you have Enoch to walk with God during your years, and so he's probably one of the few exceptions that actually lived faithfully. When God took him away, he didn't have to see death.
One of two. All right, well, let me close this in prayer. Our fathers, we do just meditate on your word and on your plan and your purpose. We thank you for it. We thank you for how this opens up our eyes to understand your global working, understand your heart, just how you are grieved over sin, Lord. Certainly even just a concept that's difficult for us to understand, but we understand, if nothing else, just the grievousness of sin. We understand just how you call us to walk with you in righteousness and faith and trust in a relationship. We just thank you for the hope that we have in doing so, Lord, that for those that trust in you, that you know how to rescue, you know how to save, you know how to deliver, even from death, even from a worldwide flood. And so we just thank you for these things. We thank you for the lessons for us. We thank you for the hope that we know that the Messiah has come. We know that your plan has been fulfilled in him and is waiting its ultimate fulfillment, just as you come to reign and to do away with sin and death and to completely undo the effects of the curse on us. We pray that as we wait for you, that we would walk in righteousness in all that we do. Lord, we thank you, we praise you, we pray that you'd apply these things to our hearts. In Christ's name, amen.